Good morning. This is James Stevenson in the NBC Newsroom in New York with your World News Roundup. This morning, following my report, we'll switch to Washington for the late news from the nation's capital. Then we'll go to Rome for news of the current wave of labor unrest, which has been paralyzing the province of Naples with strikes and demonstrations. And finally, we'll hear from Cairo, where our NBC observer is waiting to report the latest developments in the turbulent Middle East. But now, here's your announcer, and then I'll be back with your complete World News Roundup.
A glance at National Safety Council figures tells us that the death toll from street and highway accidents is three times greater during the Christmas holiday period than for any other corresponding days during the year. So if you're driving your car in the city or on the highway, watch your step. When behind the wheel, take it easy if the going is wet or icy. Keep within the speed limit at all times. Keep your distance from the car in front of you. Signal when stopping or making a turn. And watch out for pedestrians. And when on foot, look both ways before crossing a street. And when there's traffic lights, always wait for them to change in your favor before crossing at an intersection. And now back to the NBC Newsroom and the World News Roundup.
An out-and-out threat of civil war in Palestine was made today at Basel, Switzerland, where the World Zionist Congress is now in session. William B. Ziv, a New York publisher, told a press conference there that he is authorized to represent the Stern Gang, Irgun Zvi Lumi, and other Jewish underground organizations in Palestine. And they have specifically told him to say for them that if the Zionists attempt to force partition of the Holy Land or continue further collaboration with the British, such acts will be regarded as a signal for civil war. The United Nations Security Council hearing on the controversy between Greece and her northern neighbors may come to a climax and decision today when the Council meets at its headquarters at Lake Success, Long Island. The United States has proposed that an investigating group from the United Nations make a personal inspection of the border area between Greece on the south and Albania, Yugoslavia, and Bulgaria on the north, and then report its findings for final action by the Security Council. American delegate Herschel Johnson is going to try to get a vote on that proposal today. He's assured of majority support of the members, with the exception of Russia, whose single no could defeat the measure. However, Johnson is hopeful that he can argue Russian delegate Andrei Gromyko into supporting the American plan. Russia today openly charged the Iranian government with instituting a reign of terror in Azerbaijan province. The Moscow radio, quoting TASS, the official Russian news agency, devoted its entire broadcast this morning to accusations of mass murders of Azerbaijanis by Iranian troops. The broadcast also charged that Russian institutions and citizens had been attacked. General Douglas MacArthur today signed an agreement with Russia to return 50,000 Japanese war prisoners a month from Russian territory to Japan. MacArthur's headquarters announced that the Supreme Commander had offered the Soviet government enough shipping to carry 360,000 men a month, but the Russians set the limit at 50,000. Only those Japanese who want to go willingly are to be returned to their homeland. There is to be no enforced repatriation. 3 million bushels of grain were destroyed by a spectacular fire in a Minneapolis grain elevator this morning. Practically every piece of firefighting apparatus was sent into action, but it was 4 hours before the blaze was brought under control. It is still smoldering and is expected to continue to burn for several days. There was no loss of life. Property damage is estimated at over $3 million. There was another hotel fire last night, this time in Philadelphia, in the color district in the south section of the city. 5 men were burned to death and about 40 others were injured when fire broke out in a 4-story building known as Abe's Hotel. Authorities say the fire was started by a carelessly thrown lighted cigarette in a first-floor room. Interest in the possibilities of the 1948 presidential campaign is getting white hot since Minnesota's former governor, Harold Stassen, announced his candidacy for the Republican nomination 2 days ago. The last 24 hours have seen a flood of oratory and predictions. The latest to make statements are New York's Governor Thomas E. Dewey, the 1944 Republican candidate, and James A. Farley, former postmaster and Democratic national chairman. Dewey, in answering questions during a press conference, said he refused to discuss the ifs and whens of an official announcement of his candidacy. He's certainly not a candidate at this time. The CIO's United Steelworkers Wage Policy Committee, which has been meeting at Pittsburgh, has completed the draft of the demands it will make of the steel industry in the new contract negotiations. This morning, the committee is preparing to file technical strike notices with 44 major steel producers. Union officials say the strike notices will be used only if negotiations break down. The steelworkers have not specified any definite wage increase, such as was done by the United Auto Workers, who set a basic raise of 23.5 cents an hour as their goal. And now, for the late news from the nation's capital, we switch to NBC in Washington.
This is Bjorn Bjornsson in Washington. Senator Bilbo, the man himself, will take the witness stand today. Senators investigating Bilbo's financial activities will turn their attention to him at a hearing beginning this morning. The Mississippi senator seems entirely unperturbed by the mass of accusations that have been thrown at him, and he doesn't seem worried about what today's session may bring forth. Commenting on the hearing, he told a reporter yesterday, "They have not shown a thing except that I got an automobile and I owe a lot of debts." He was referring to testimony brought out in a full week of hearings. Witnesses testified about thousands of dollars in campaign contributions, alimony payments, and gifts of an expensive automobile, a new home, an artificial lake, and an elaborate parsonage. Charges of perjury and contempt of the Senate were ordered brought against the last witness to testify yesterday. He was Bilbo's former secretary, Edward P. Terry. He seemed perfectly willing to testify about dealings he and the senator had had with various war contractors and Bilbo supporters. But when attention was turned to him and what had become of the $15,000 he admitted he received last year to defeat Bilbo, he closed up. He was still Bilbo's secretary when this money was paid over to him. He testified reluctantly that the $15,000 was given him by a Simon Lieberman of New York City. When he couldn't find somebody to run against Bilbo, he said he returned the money. But he got his dates a bit mixed up. Lieberman had been dead for 5 months on the date he said he paid back the funds. Terry was summarily dismissed after he had twice refused to tell the whole story. Elsewhere in Washington, the soft coal operators are meeting today. They are getting together to discuss the question of resuming wage negotiations with John L. Lewis and his United Mine Workers. Federal officials, although most anxious to get out of the coal business, deny any responsibility for calling this conference. The administration, however, is ready to encourage talks between Lewis and the operators. And at 3 o'clock this afternoon, the National Federation of Telephone Workers will announce its wage and other contract demands. About 300,000 employees of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company and independent telephone firms are represented. This independent union is undertaking to bargain with employers on a nationwide basis on wages and 9 other contract issues. Most of the telephone contracts will expire in March. This is Bjorn Bjornsson in Washington, returning you to NBC in New York.
Naples is paralyzed by a general strike which has been called by Italian labor leaders in protest against living conditions and government handling of food distribution. Here's a first-hand report from NBC in Rome.
This is Jack Begon speaking from Rome. Rioting and unrest continued for the third day in Naples this morning, despite yesterday's radio plea for order by Premier De Gasperi. Not only is the strike continuing in Naples, but similar disturbances have either occurred or are threatened in Salerno and other South Italy towns. The strike, which has paralyzed most of Naples, was originally called to protest a threatened reduction in already insufficient food rationing. It is not entirely free from political influences, however, since the leftist elements in the province are open in their efforts to mobilize mass worker protests against the newly elected monarchist mayor and the Christian Democrat government of De Gasperi. U.S. military authorities, trying to avoid any anti-Allied actions, have declared the entire city off-limits to all troops. The local Christian Democrat newspaper was forced by the strikers to suspend publication for having criticized the strike, but all other newspapers are still publishing. All restaurants of the first and second class are closed. The strike leaders allowed the trattorias, workmen's eating places, to remain open. The only bright spot in the troubled situation was the announcement that Naples port workers have resumed loading and unloading ships. Despite efforts by workmen themselves to keep discipline, numerous incidents have occurred. One was touched off when a local newspaper announced that 75 tons of unrest supplies had been found spoiled in a warehouse. An unsuccessful attempt was made to break into a U.S. Army food warehouse at the railhead outside the city, and similar incidents were reported inside Naples. In Rome this morning, government officials issued statements assuring the people that all possible efforts were being made to divert food from the north where supplies are more adequate to southern Italy. But on-the-spot observers in Naples do not agree with the official spokesman who say the strike is about to be called off. The shortage of food in southern Italy is not a thing that can be solved by words. People are hungry, and this, plus an unsettled political situation, means trouble unless something concrete is done, and quickly. This is Jack Begon in Rome, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
The possibility of Russian intervention in Azerbaijan is seen following today's Soviet charge that Iranian troops are conducting a campaign of terror and attacking Russian citizens and property. For late news of this and other developments in the Middle East, we switch to NBC in Cairo.
This is John Donovan speaking from Cairo. Unconfirmed reports from Iran say that in Azerbaijan, 600 persons have been killed and 300 arrested. Radio Moscow has also reported that a reign of terror is being conducted by the Iranian government against the people of Azerbaijan. In Cairo, Mohammed Ali Jinnah, passing en route to India and president of the Indian Muslim League, conducted a press conference this morning for correspondents in Egypt. The aging, dyspeptic Indian leader held forth like an irritable schoolteacher in stating his case for an independent Pakistan. Several correspondents walked out as the minority leader condescendingly gave geography and history lessons which were in accord with his point of view. Mr. Jinnah said that Egypt and the entire Middle East would be menaced by a united India, because united India would mean a government of Hindu imperialists. In effect, Mr. Jinnah continued, India and the Middle East, by ridding themselves of the British and accepting a united India, are out of the frying pan and into the fire. Jinnah insists that the 100 million Muslims of India have as much right to independence as any of the European and Middle Eastern countries, possessing far smaller populations. Jinnah restated the Pakistan point of view made at the London conference and opposes any federation with Hindu Indians. Jinnah feels that Britain should play a secondary role in the Muslim-Hindu dispute over unity and Pakistan. Jinnah has been placed in an anomalous position by stating his views in Egypt at this time. As a spokesman for disunity in India and in appealing for the establishment of an Indian independent Muslim state of Pakistan, Jinnah arrived in Egypt when the Egyptians are forcing the issue of unity with the Sudan. Even now, the long drawn out Anglo-Egyptian negotiations are hamstrung by the opposing views held by the Egyptian and British governments. This is John Donovan in Cairo, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Jim Farley, former postmaster and Democratic National Chairman, told a New York press conference that in his judgment, the Democratic Party can put up a real fight in 1948 if it reorganizes itself and brings in new blood with aggressive, competent leadership from top to bottom. More news in a moment. In the meantime, here is your announcer.
Are you wondering about that extra special Christmas present you want to get for some friend or one of your family? Perhaps you've run out of ideas or can't find just what you want. Well, here's a suggestion that may have slipped your mind. A $100 United States savings bond. They say that one thing leads to another, and so the gift of one savings bond can lead to the purchase of more, with the result that soon a tidy nest egg has been accumulated that will pay off in the form of a long-desired trip, college education for the children, or even a charming house in the country or near the seashore. Not only do savings bonds mean something for the future, but by buying bonds now, you're helping combat the strong inflationary pressures which still threaten to drive prices of goods and services sky high. If you're Christmas shopping the savings bond way, you need only go to your nearest bank or post office. If you're thinking of U.S. savings bonds for yourself as a regular and safe investment, ask your employer about the convenient payroll savings plan. And now back to the newsroom.
That cold wave, which has been moving eastward across the country, is going to hit the Atlantic seaboard sometime today, spreading south all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. At the same time, Weather Bureau officials say that Midwest and Plains states will be getting some relief from sub-zero temperatures tomorrow. This morning, the temperature in Minnesota ranges from 10 to 15 below zero. Wisconsin and Upper Michigan are also getting sub-zero weather, and freezing temperatures reported as far south as Alabama. 2,500 soft coal miners of the Consolidation Coal Company of Fairmont, West Virginia, are going to enjoy a happy Christmas, despite the cold weather and their loss of 17 days' pay in the recent strike. The company has announced that every man on its payroll today will receive a $50 advance in wages out of January work, so that there'll be money for the holidays. The announcement was described by union officials as one of the finest acts they'd ever heard of. And that's today's complete world news roundup. This is James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York, and I'll be seeing you tomorrow morning.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Sunoco, S-U-N-O-C-O. Sunoco presents Lowell Thomas. Friends, why? Why is it that Sun Oil Company can sell you high-test Sunoco Dynafuel without charging you the high-test price? It's because there are no second or third grades of this wonder fuel to increase our production, transportation, and selling costs. Instead, such great savings are effected that we're able to sell Dynafuel at less than other high-test gasolines. That's why
you save up to 2 cents. Yes, you save up to 2 cents a gallon.
So switch to superpower, switch to super smoothness. Switch to money-saving Dynafuel. Sunoco Dynafuel, and save as you drive. Now, Lowell Thomas.
Good evening, everybody. Uncle Sam has not yet achieved or secured the peace for which the men of our armed forces fought at a cost of more than 1 million casualties. That was the gist of President Truman's Christmas message to wounded war veterans this evening. The president added, however, that as Christmas approaches, the picture is not too discouraging. There is increasing hope for believing that the patient cooperation of men and women everywhere working together in unity can establish mutual understanding and justice and thereby bring about world peace. So said the president. And he added, I know we can do it. I believe we will. In many ways, he went on, we have moved nearer to the goal than we were last year. But we've made mistakes and we've suffered delays. And then he used these words to the veterans. I feel sure that this new year will bring us closer to what you must have for a happier, more abundant life. The lights on the Christmas tree on the south lawn of the White House are going to be turned on at dusk Christmas Eve, about 5:15 next Tuesday. And Mr. Truman will broadcast a Christmas message to the country. Christmas morning at 8 o'clock, Mr. Truman will fly home to Independence, Missouri, there to celebrate Christmas with his mother. Mrs. Truman and his daughter left Washington for Missouri by train last night. The Veterans Administration took action today to protect servicemen from being gouged over their real estate transactions. This because appraisers have been exaggerating the value of properties offered to veterans. When the Veterans Administration began guaranteeing GI loans, lenders were allowed to choose their own appraisers, with results unfortunate for the serviceman. So all this is to be done away with now. Already hundreds of appraisers have been fired, and more still are to be discarded. In the future, the Veterans Administration will select the appraisers. The leaders of five veterans organizations met the new housing expediter in Washington today. They wanted to learn what the administration was doing to provide more housing. The expediter promised them a speed up and undertook that there would be no use of materials to build anything but residences. One of the reforms the Republicans will try to achieve in Washington will be the departure of as many as possible of the numerous press agents to be found on the federal government payrolls. At least, that's the plan of Congressman John Tabor of New York, who will be chairman of the Appropriations Committee of the House. Congressman Tabor announced today that he intends to clean out government press agentry and do it in a wholesale way. He has asked the director of the budget for a complete list of the federal government officials with complete details about who they are, how much they earn, what they do, how well qualified they are to do it. Congressman Tabor believes that most of the federal information services are really propaganda agencies. Said he, propaganda staffs never tell the truth if they can help it. He added that government agencies have been pouring out a steady stream of propaganda in the form of press releases, known in the newspaper trade as handouts. Congressman Tabor said that one consequence of this situation is that newspapermen in Washington have become so lazy that present-day reporters can't turn out a story until they get a handout. Well, some Washington observers got a chuckle out of Congressman Tabor's proposal today. They point out that it may be embarrassing to Republican Congressman Harold Knutson of Minnesota, who will be chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, because Congressman Knutson has been thinking of engaging a public relations counsel for his committee just to keep the public informed about tax matters. Over in Europe, there are many thousands of people who want to come to the United States, and there are thousands who have obtained permission to immigrate. Although they have their passports and they have their visas, so far they have been unable to come to the promised land, all because of a lack of transportation. So today, President Truman ordered four ships of Uncle Sam's Maritime Commission to go over to Europe and get them and bring them here. And we all hope that they will make good citizens. Soviet Russia wants the United Nations to investigate Greece thoroughly and drastically, conduct a searching inquiry into military affairs in Greece. Ah, but not investigate Greece's neighbors, Yugoslavia, Romania, and Albania. That was the burden of a vehement speech by Delegate Gromyko before the UN Security Council at Lake Success today. Russia would permit limited investigation of its puppet states, but only the border areas. The American delegation promptly objected, said the United States could not agree to any proposition which determined beforehand who was to blame in the Balkans. William B. Ziff, a New York author of a highly impassioned book called The Rape of Palestine, enlightened the proceedings of the Zionist Congress over in Switzerland today. He made a statement to a press conference there. He appeared there, he said, as a spokesman for the Stern Gang and for the Irguns Vaaleumi of Palestine. And then Ziff went on to add that he spoke not as a delegate to the Congress, but as an individual American citizen. Ziff uttered warnings of immediate civil war in the Holy Land if there were any attempt to compromise the Jewish claim to all Palestine, or if there were any further collaboration on the part of the Zionists with the British to end active resistance. He denied that the Stern Gang and the Irguns Vaaleumi are terrorists. That word, he said, is a British invention. And he charged that Lieutenant General Sir Evelyn Barker, the British commander in Egypt, had caused all Jews within a mile of Sir Evelyn's residence to be removed. At that point, a Jewish correspondent spoke up and contradicted him. The Jewish correspondent said that he himself lived within 200 yards of General Barker. Ziff made no answer to that. He just went on to say that the active resistance forces in Palestine number from 15,000 to 20,000 men, fully armed, operating under the command of leaders of recognized military genius, and that large groups of Haganah, the moderate underground army, are supporting them too. All in all, he figured that the active resistance forces could mobilize 50,000 to 75,000 men. The British had announced that the Stern Gang numbered less than 600, Irguns Vaaleumi about 2,000. Ziff went on to say that the organizations had asked him to announce that they would retaliate if there is any witch hunt in Palestine. They will not even discuss anything with the British so long as what they call pressure and persecution continue. If the leaders of the Zionist Congress insist upon collaborating with the British, then they will be looked upon as quislings. The Zionist Organization of America injected further discord into the scene at Basel, Switzerland today with a statement rebuking the venerable Dr. Chaim Weizmann. The ZOA declared that in his address of Monday night, Dr. Weizmann had so distorted the actions of American Zionists that he had made it appear that they were encouraging the youth of Palestine to expose themselves to danger while the Zionists themselves remained safely in America. The people of Iran will go to the polls on Sunday to elect a new parliament. The premier today promised a free election with punishment for anyone who tries to bulldoze the Persian voters. Premier Gavam promises that if his government is supported, he will carry out reforms for the peasants and for labor. Russian newspapers today published an accusation that Premier Gavam's troops in Azerbaijan are carrying out mass executions, with 600 communists shot so far and 300 more arrested. Winston Churchill today hurled a withering blast at the Attlee government. He accused it of tyranny, conceit, and incompetence. Churchill announced that after the holiday recess, he'll move for a vote of no confidence. This was Winston Churchill's response to the Socialist Cabinet's demand for control of farming, control almost as rigid as that exercised by the Nazis and the Soviets. One provision of the program would mean that if a farmer declined to comply with government regulations or were inefficient, then the British government could take his land away from him. However, he would be paid for it. A government spokesman explained that this control was to produce a higher quality of farm operation in Britain. The act would also enable the government to declare a state of emergency, bring back wartime controls, and tell each farmer just what crops he could grow and what livestock he could raise. Such was the measure that aroused the ire of the wartime prime minister today. Senator Bilbo spoke out in his own defense today. Bilbo read from a statement, 41 pages long, 10,000 words, a typical Bilbo harangue. He was talking for his political life, and he brought in the names of the savior, of George Washington and Julius Caesar. After mentioning them, he used these words, "I claim to have the greatest traitor of them all in my trusted secretary." He then compared that secretary to Judas Iscariot, Brutus, and Benedict Arnold. He denied ever having received a cent of improper money. Of the checks made out to his order, Bilbo explained that every cent had been turned over to his political managers for campaign expenses, not always his own, but largely the expenses of candidates who had been defeated in the primaries. That seems to be an old Mississippi custom. If you defeat your rival in the primaries, you pay his expenses so that he won't turn against you at the general election. Bilbo admitted having received a loan of $1,200, said he had paid part of it back and would pay the rest. He is, he explained, slow pay but sure. He is also a poor but honest man, heavily in debt. Along with his former secretary, he denounced his one-time friend, now opponent, Representative Ross Collins of Mississippi. He declared that the agitation against him had been worked up by Negroes, communists, personal enemies, and Yankee pinks. He admitted having received gifts of furniture and motor cars, but said they were Christmas presents and that there was sound precedent for people in public life receiving Christmas presents of motor cars. The most sensational testimony of the day was given by Dr. H.J. Onslinger, chief of Uncle Sam's Narcotics Bureau, who told how late in 1945 he, the doctor, visited Bilbo's office in Washington. The senator wanted the Narcotics Bureau to permit one of his constituents to have morphine. He showed Dr. Onslinger a letter, including certificates from two doctors, who swore that there was real medical need for morphine in the case and that if it were withheld, then the patient might die. On the strength of those letters, Dr. Onslinger said that he notified one of the doctors that the Narcotics Bureau would sanction a prescription of 2 grams of morphine a day for that Bilbo constituent. Then came the climax. Dr. Onslinger proceeded to testify that an Internal Revenue agent told him that Senator Bilbo received $1,500 for that medication, that the agent had the evidence on this. As Dr. Onslinger said this, Senator Tunnell of Delaware warned him, "You're making a very serious charge against a United States senator." Bilbo denied the accusation categorically, said it was due to the treacherous calumny of his former secretary, the Judas Iscariot. Some 35 years ago or thereabouts, a man living in Billings, Montana, went to Canada, leaving behind a little son. The father did pretty well in Canada and elsewhere. And a few years ago, he became remorseful about the lad that he had abandoned at Billings. The father spent the last years of his life traveling all over the West, looking for traces of his son. At the same time, his son, who had joined the Coast Guard, became a junior grade lieutenant. The son was in the East looking for his father. Well, the melancholy part about the story is that the father died 10 days ago at the age of 94. He had been living in a $5-a-week room at Buffalo, cooking his own meals on a gas range. His last days were spent in anguish because he had failed to find any trace of his son. And as he passed away, he left a message begging the public administrator of Buffalo to find the son, all of which has come to pass. The Buffalo public administrator has identified Lieutenant Donald Talford as the missing son. The lieutenant lives in Portland, Oregon, and to the lieutenant will go some $50,000 left by the father who had abandoned him long ago. The court in Milwaukee today decided that it is not nice for a private to turn a corporal over his knee and administer a spanking. The corporal in the case is a WAC who served in the Southwest Pacific and won a lot of ribbons. Her husband was only a private first class. Although he served in the China-Burma-India theater, the little woman had more ribbons than he. And every time they had a disagreement, why, she'd rub it in by throwing out her chest, so to speak. Finally, it became too much for him, and he took to spanking her. The judge said, "Papa shouldn't spank," and give the lady a divorce. I'm sure you would never take your beautiful wife over your
knee. Better not, Lowell. Lowell, do you know there are more than 400 petroleum refiners in America? They make more than 1,000 different brands of gasoline. And all of them are in vigorous competition with the others to win your patronage by bringing you better quality at lower prices. Who benefits most by such competition? Why, you do. For it's such competition which brings down prices, builds up quality. And Sunoco's entry in this competition is Dynafuel, the wonder fuel of the year. The motor fuel with premium performance, but without the premium price. How about testing a tank full of Dynafuel in your car? Now, Lowell Thomas says...
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.